This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is Richard Snow, author of A Measureless Peril, America in the Fight for the Atlantic, the Longest Battle of World War II. And it seems especially appropriate to talk about this topic as we honor those who have served our nation and given their lives for our nation on this Memorial Day. And Richard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The Battle of the Atlantic, it's often not talked about, especially in a European theater that's been scrutinized so much in so many ways, especially D-Day, the land invasion, and just the different tactics on land. Why do you think the Battle for the Atlantic hasn't gotten the amount of attention that it probably should have?
I think because even at the time, people didn't see it as a battle. A naval battle, when you think of the classic tradition, it's like what's happening on the other side of the world at Midway. Two carrier fleets come together and the fate of nations are decided in minutes. This was 6 years long, and it was a delivery system, basically, that America and Britain was trying to keep up and going, and the German submarines were trying to destroy. It was bringing food, guns, eventually troops from America to England. Now, but even at the time, as I say, people didn't see it as a coherent effort, but one who did recognize its importance was Winston Churchill, from whom I stole my title, because after the war, he said during the entire fight, the whole thing, the only thing that really scared him, and he had plenty to choose from, was the German U-boat campaign, what he called, how often, he said, would I have gladly and traded a full-scale invasion for this measureless peril? And by measureless, he meant not only the furtive, almost invisible quality of the U-boats that were sinking his ships, but also, it was so hard to keep track of who was winning or losing, because the Germans weren't interested in sinking English and American war vessels. They wanted to sink the supply ships, because they wanted to starve out Britain, and they came very close to doing it.
We're talking with Richard Snow. The book is A Measureless Peril. And Richard, the U.S. had a couple of major challenges here. First of all, after the First World War, we had hunkered down into an isolationist type of standpoint, although President Roosevelt was starting to loosen that in a lot of different ways before we were officially in the war.
Exactly, yes.
And then, of course, there's the problem with the U-boat campaign, which we had dealt with to some extent in the First World War as well. How do we go about taking on those two huge challenges, building an Atlantic fleet and devising a way to take out the U-boats?
Story. It was and so you might think of the battle as actually a thousand battles. At the very center of this was the world's least interesting weapon, an ash can, the sailors called it. It was depth charge. It was about as primitive as you could get. It was 300 pounds of TNT in a garbage pail, basically. You drop that on the submarine. Powerful, would work. But to get it to the submarine, we had to go through so many expanding circles of improvisation, theoretical research, of the extemporization, and it brought out what I think America so often shows when it's really under the hammer is a willingness for very different groups of people to cooperate together and unleash new energies that bring about new solutions. I among the very many things, radar, sonar, we invented two entirely new kinds of ships that had never invented before. Well, and one of them was a baby flat top. It was built on a freighter hull. It only had 10, 20 planes, but it didn't need a lot of planes. It wasn't going to be fighting other planes. It was going to be looking for U-boats. So suddenly your range of vision expands by hundreds of miles. And the other one was the destroyer escort, which I'm fond of because my father served on one. But these were basically cheap, small, off-the-shelf destroyers built out of small parts. The spare parts, some of them were powered by railroad diesels, and they weren't fast as real destroyers, but they were nimble. They could stay on top of U-boats. They had the kind of weapons to cope with them. And we invented new ways of building them. The whole nation became a sort of massive, like, automobile assembly line. Many of the hulls were built in the famous seaport town of Denver and then taken down the Mississippi to ports where they were put together. They were And by the end of the war, we went from having almost no escort vessels to over 700 destroyer escorts. So when the final German push came, we had plenty of ships left to meet it.
Couple minutes left in our conversation with Richard Snow. The book is A Measureless Peril. A couple things I'd like to get to in that remaining time, Richard. First of all, the name Carl Dönitz is certainly one that World War II buffs know pretty well. Ernest King, the U.S. commander, not so much. What did he bring to the fight that helped us?
That's a very good point. He should be known as well as Eisenhower. He brought to the fight the worst temper of any Allied high commander, and I think the most intelligence. He, while the smoke was still clearing over Pearl Harbor, he had in his mind exactly how this war was going to be fought. And he had the grasp of a global vision, but also a very fine grasp of details. And so as he took hold of it, it took him a while too, but once he took hold of the Atlantic campaign, he ran it with really heroic efficiency and imagination, but he is not somebody you'd want to meet. He was scary.
You mentioned before that the Battle of the Atlantic is not like the Battle in the Pacific. You didn't have aircraft carrier groups and naval destroyer groups meeting each other head-to-head, but is there a distinguished point in those 6 years where it was clear that the Allies had taken command of the Atlantic?
Yes, yes. It's not a point, but really there was just a rolling sense over the months that things had shifted in our favor. We were sinking more U-boats than they were sinking us. The British had an enormous amount to do with this, but so too did the Americans with our tremendous industrial capacity. But by the end of the war, the Germans, just as determined as they had been in the beginning, were still putting out, but now they had a 75% chance of never coming back. Those are higher casualties than those sustained by any service in the war, and that is a reflection of what we had been working on all those years.
Last question before we let you go. Richard, as you mentioned a moment ago, your father's service in the battle for the Atlantic got you very much interested in this topic, but one of the things that makes this book so great is all the different personal stories that you researched and the interviews that you did as far as people who served in all different aspects of this fight. What did you appreciate most across the board about all these veterans you spoke to and researched?
The thing that stays with me is how willing they were to stop what they were doing and take up this bigger job, and not one of them seems to have resented. My father had his own architecture practice when the war started. He never got it back again when it was over, and you know, every now and then he'd get a little sentimental about it, but he never missed it for a minute, and he was never sorry he went. I know people who had very grim times in that war, much, much worse than he did, but the thing that unites them, I think, is the knowledge that they were working together for a titanic goal that they succeeded triumphantly in reaching.
Richard, very well stated, and of course we thank veterans of that generation and every generation for the freedoms that we enjoy today. Thank you, sir, very much for your time.
Thank you. This was great.
Richard Snow is the author of A Measureless Peril, America in the Fight for the Atlantic, the longest battle of World War II. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.